This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Suspect, written by Fiona Barton, performed by Claire Corbett, Ria Zmitrovic, Sean Thomas, and Mark Meadows. For Beatrice, Arthur, Jemima, Olive, and Isabel. Never let the truth get in the way of a good story. Anon. Part 1. The Job.
Chapter 1. Sunday, the 27th of July, 2014. The Reporter. The call comes at 3 a.m. The jagged ring of the bedside telephone tearing a hole in our sleep. I reach out a hand to silence it. Hello? I whisper. Static whispers back at me. I press the phone harder to my ear.
Who is this?
I feel Steve roll over to face me, but he doesn't speak. The hissing static fades, and I hear a voice.
Hello? Hello?
It says, searching for me. I sit bolt upright and switch on the light. Steve groans and rubs his eyes.
Kate, what's going on?
He says. Who is this? I repeat. But I know. Jake?
Mum?
The voice says, the word distorted by distance. Or drink, perhaps, I think uncharitably.
Sorry I missed your birthday,
he says. The line fizzes again, and he's gone. I look at Steve.
Was it him?
He asks. I nod. He's sorry he missed my birthday. It's the first time in 7 months that he's phoned. There have been 3 emails, but our eldest son had told us from the start that he wouldn't be contactable by phone. Said he was freeing himself of all the stress that constant calls would bring. He'd keep in touch with us. When he last rang, it was Christmas morning. We'd hoped he'd be back home with us, pulling crackers and making his lethal mulled wine. We'd suggested and then pleaded by email, even buying a plane ticket when he seemed to weaken. But Jake had stayed away, managing only a 10-minute call on the day. Steve had answered the phone and spoken to him first, while I hovered beside him. Then Jake had asked to speak to his little brother, Freddie. And finally, his mother. I'd hugged the phone, as if I could feel the heft and warmth of him, and tried to listen, not talk. But he'd remained distant as the seconds counted down in the phone booth somewhere, and I'd found myself turning inquisitor. So where are you now, love?
Here,
he'd laughed. Still in Phuket?
Yes, yes.
And are you working?
Yeah, sure. Doing this and that.
How are you managing for money?
I'm managing, Mum. Don't worry about me. I'm fine.
Well, as long as you are happy, I'd heard myself say. The coward's way out.
Yes, I am.
After I'd put the phone down, Freddie had put a glass of Prosecco in my hand and kissed my cheek.
Come on, Mum. He's fine. Having a brilliant time lying around in the sun while we're sitting here in the rain.
But I'd known deep down he wasn't fine. His voice had become wary. And that nervy laugh. He didn't sound like my Jake anymore.
Chapter 2. Friday, the 15th of August, 2014. The Mother. Leslie searched the inbox again, just in case she'd missed it. She knew she hadn't, but stopping looking would mean they had to act. They'd agreed. Malcolm stood behind her, watching her every move. She could feel the tension radiating off him. Anything? He asked. No. I'm ringing the police. She nodded. They'd never had to ring the police before in all their married life. The police belonged to another world, the world they saw on television or in the papers, not theirs. She was shaking as Malcolm picked up the phone. She wanted to tell him to wait, to give it another day, not to start this, not to bring this into their home. Mal, she said. But he looked at her as he dialed, silencing her. She could hear the hum of the fridge and a car passing by outside. Life going on.
"Hello, I'd like to report my daughter missing," she heard him say.
That life was over.
"A week. We haven't heard from her or the friends she's with for almost a week," he said. "Her A-level results came out yesterday, but she still hasn't been in touch. She's Alexandra O'Connor, 18. Her birthday was in May."
Leslie remembered icing the birthday cake. Didn't look anything like Ed Sheeran apart from the red hair, but Alex had loved it. She tuned back in to hear her husband apologising.
"Sorry, I thought I'd said. She's in Thailand, backpacking with her friend, Rosie Shaw. Her last text message said they were still in Bangkok."
It took another 20 minutes for Malcolm to explain the situation, give his details and listen to the advice. When he put the phone down, he rubbed his eyes and kept his hands there for a moment.
"What? What did they say?"
Leslie said, the panic making her voice loud and unlike her.
"Who did you talk to? Tell me!"
Her husband jerked his head up and looked at her as if to reassure himself that this woman shrieking in their kitchen was his wife.
"They took down all the details, love. You heard me. I spoke to a woman officer. I wrote it all down on a bit of paper."
He reached over to the worktop and picked up a post-it note.
"Here, look."
Leslie brushed it aside so it floated to the tiled floor.
"Never mind that. What did this woman say? What are they going to do to find Alex and Rosie?"
Malcolm stooped to pick up the piece of paper and put it back on the worktop. Leslie wanted to hit him.
"Malcolm! Sorry, love, but we're going to need this."
He spoke slowly as if she were an elderly relative.
"She said she's going to pass on the details to Interpol, and we should ring the British Embassy in Bangkok. That's what they advise. But she said this happens a lot. Young people going travelling and forgetting to contact their parents. She said it was early days and that we should try not to worry." "So she thinks it's going to be all right?"
Leslie willed him to say yes or nod.
"Let it be all right."
Malcolm shook his head.
"She doesn't know, love. We've to ring her if Alex gets in touch, or if we don't hear from her in another week." "She will get in touch, won't she?"
Malcolm pulled her to him.
"Of course she will. She'll want to know her A-level results. Tomorrow or the next day, she'll turn up like a bad penny."
Leslie wiped her eyes with a paper towel and tried to look hopeful.
"I'd better ring Jenny back," she said, grateful there was something practical to be done. "I told her I'd be in touch as soon as we'd spoken to the police. She got a bit funny about it yesterday." "I think she's as frantic as we are. Rosie's her only one, and Jenny's on her own."
Malcolm was tapping at the keyboard of the laptop.
"The police want a photo. I said I'd send one. Then I'll find the number for the embassy."
Leslie looked over his shoulder. He'd picked the one Alex had sent of her and Rosie in a tuk-tuk on the day they arrived, grinning madly, their surroundings a blur.
"At least they're together,"
Leslie said and wept, her head on her arms on their kitchen table.
Bangkok, Day 1. Sunday, the 27th of July, 2014. Alex O'Connor, Sunday at 5 a.m, is here. It's brilliant. The adventure starts now. Her fingers danced over the keys of her phone, posting the selfie on Facebook of her standing in front of Suvarnabhumi Airport with tired eyes and a silly grin on her face. She'd planned this photo on the plane, but she hadn't factored in the noise and heat as the terminal doors slid open. It had shaken her physically. She'd known it would be hot, but not like this. Her face was wet and strands of hair were plastered to her forehead. The air was so thick she could taste it on her tongue. She put her backpack down carefully, trapping it with her feet to keep it safe, and stretched her arms above her head, feeling the first buzz of freedom. Alex had looked forward to this for a year, fantasizing about places, people, adventures, while she worked for her A-levels and stacked shelves to earn the money. She'd looked forward to everything about it, starting with the flight. She'd always loved the sensation of suddenly rushing down the runway towards something new. And she'd felt the same thrill as the engines revved at the start of this, her first long haul taking her across the world. But the sensation had worn off quickly. It was 11 hours of sitting in a middle seat, trying not to touch the arm of the person next to her, hidden under thin blankets like a corpse. Rosie had had 3 glasses of wine with her hideous airline meal, the chicken or the pasta, and Alex had warned her she'd get dehydrated. Her friend had rolled her eyes and made a big show of flirting with the man on her other side, before falling asleep and snoring gently. Alex had tried to sleep too, squirming in her narrow seat to find a comfortable position, pulling up her blanket and uncovering her feet, fidgeting with her seatbelt to stop it digging into her hip. In the end, she'd sat in the dark and watched films on the tiny screen in front of her until her eyes stung. When the lights came back on an hour before landing, she'd unbuckled and gone to the toilet. Her face in the mirror looked weird, eyes red-rimmed and mouth slack with sleep deprivation. She'd yawned at herself and wrestled with the unfamiliar door to get out, suddenly panicky. There'd been a boy standing waiting when she burst out. She'd laughed at herself. They're a real mare to unlock, aren't they? He'd smiled shyly back and let her past. And now she was here, Bangkok. She picked up her backpack and swung it heavily onto her shoulder and staggered slightly, dizzy from the sudden movement. She felt stiff and spacey, as if her feet weren't quite touching the ground. Strangers were asking her to come with them, small men with wide smiles and insistent hands. You need a taxi? I know good guest house. You want to see temple? She stood, the choices drumming on her skull. It was 5 a.m, dark, hot, and she wanted to lie down. Come on, Alex, let's go, she told herself. Where's Rosie? Her friend had wandered off, looking for something for her headache. You shouldn't have had all that wine on the plane. Didn't you bring any paracetamol? Alex had said, reaching to unzip the side pocket of her bag. No, Rosie had snapped and marched off. Alex hoped it was going to be all right. Anyway, it was too late for doubts. They were here, and it was brilliant. Well, it would be.
Chapter 3. Friday, the 15th of August, 2014. The Detective. D.S. Zara Salmond was treading so lightly around D.I. Bob Sparks that morning, it felt like he was being stalked. She was always just out of sight, but she couldn't have been more intrusive if she'd been holding up a neon sign saying, "The boss's wife is dying." Eileen's cancer had come back 2 months ago, blowing new holes in her, murdering her slowly. "We can beat this," he'd told her after the latest results came back. "We've done it once. We can do it again." The kids had cried with him at home, away from their mother. Sam rang every day before she left for work and when she got home, and passed on any news to her brother. Everyone was being strong for each other, and the effort was exhausting. It was all he could do to get out of bed some mornings. Work had been fantastic, his bosses urging him to take as much time off as he needed, but Sparks could not settle at the hospital or at home. He needed something in his life that was not about cancer. He needed to pretend that a normal life was possible, for Eileen's sake, and to distract his aching heart. But he had clearly forgotten to brief D.S. Salmond. He knew she was keeping the rabble in the incident room from his door out of kindness, but Sparks lost it when he overheard his detective sergeant telling a colleague, "You'll have to come back later. He's not having a good day." He could picture her caring look and shouted, "Salmond! Get in here!" When she put her neatly groomed head round the door, he wiped the smile off her face. "You are getting right up my nose, Salmond. Stop telling people to leave me alone. Go and do something useful. I feel as if I'm being quarantined." The DS tried to laugh it off, but Bob knew he'd been too rough. He stood to stop her leaving. "Sorry, it's just that when you're talking about me, you sound as if you're dealing with a jumper on a bridge. I'm all right."
"Okay, boss. Point taken. I'll leave you to it. I've got reports to finish."
"Tell me what you're up to." He pointed to a chair. Salmond sat and crossed her arms. Still defensive, Bob thought. Come on, Zara. Remind me.
Well, I'm chasing up the final results on the drugs bust out at Portsmouth.
It's a bit slow, isn't it?
Yes. Well, people have been off for the summer holidays.
Anything to worry about?
No, all looks tidy. Oh, and we've had a report of two girls from Winchester going missing.
Missing? How old? He said, immediately on full alert. When did this come in? Why didn't you tell me straight away?
They're 18 and missing in Thailand.
Ah, Sparks muttered, his mind slipping away to the meeting with Eileen's consultant later.
Bit off our patch, but I'm up for it if you want to send...
D.S. Salmon said, a shade louder to show she'd noticed his eyes glazing over. In your dreams, Zara. Anyway, you've just been away.
Hardly a holiday, boss. When Neil said Turkey, I thought sun loungers. We spent most of the time looking at ancient latrines for his Year 10s project, in 40-degree heat.
Latrines? Excellent. Any photos? Salmon laughed.
Neil's got loads. I'll ask him to send you a selection.
Yeah, no hurry. What about these girls, then?
It's only been a week, but the parents are twitchy. The girls are away for the first time and didn't ring for their A-level results yesterday. The dad of one of them phoned it in this morning, and I'm passing on the details to Interpol, but my bet is they'll be on a beach somewhere. Lucky them.
Yes, lucky them. Well, let me know if you hear anything more. And he winked to let her know they were all right.
Quick update, sir,
Salmon said 20 minutes later.
The press officer briefed about the backpackers, and there's a Facebook campaign already running. The family are doing it.
Sparks pulled a face.
It's a good idea, sir. That's where kids who might be sitting in a bar next to Alex and Rosie will be looking.
Yes, them and every weirdo and glory seeker on the planet, offering fake sympathy and sightings just to be part of the drama. And then there'll be the trolls, blaming the parents for letting their kids go travelling, calling the girls slappers and whores. God, who opened the microphone to people like them? At least before social media, you didn't have to hear this stuff. They could sit in the snug of their local pub or their front room and spout their bile.
Anyway, Salmon said, moving on...
Yes, let's. Sparks was looking at reports on screen, his head elsewhere. He leaned back, stretched out his arms to touch the computer, and then lifted them over his head, making his back click. There was a metallic taste in his mouth, and he could no longer get out of his chair without an involuntary groan. He felt old. Really old. Eileen had said he needed more sleep when he'd gone in to see her that morning, but he had waved her concerns away. I'm fine, love. Why are we talking about me? Let's concentrate on you and getting rid of this stupid infection and restarting your treatment. She'd lain back on her pillow.
I am trying, Bob.
He tried to focus on the words on his screen, but his head was full of the growing fragility in his wife's eyes. They were sinking into her head, away from him. It was as if she were being hollowed out. He flexed and clenched his fingers. Not now. Can't think about it now. It'll be all right. He tapped the touchpad to awaken his screen, and a photo appeared. D.S. Salmon had uploaded images of the missing girls and the link to the Facebook page the O'Connors had set up. Sparks looked at the girls' faces and sighed. He clicked and began reading, starting with Alex's last Facebook post and email home on Saturday the 9th of August. Alex O'Connor, Saturday at 11 a.m, is planning to celebrate her A-level results with her bezzy in Kopeepi, gazing out at monolithic rocks in an azure blue sea, according to Lonely Planet. From Alex O'Connor to Les and Mal O'Connor, subject, results. Hi, Mum and Dad. Still in Bangkok. So much to see, we've decided to stay longer, but planning to move on in time for the results. Everything crossed that I get into Warwick. We'll ring, like we said, about 12 noon your time, 1800 here, on the 14th of August, to open the envelope together. Like the Oscars. Text me if the post arrives earlier. Love you, Alex. Kiss, kiss. P.S. Seeing elephants tomorrow. Another bucket list item ticked off. The alarm was sounded by Alex O'Connor's brother, quietly at first. More of a nudge, really. Hi, Alex. Haven't heard from you for a couple of days. Where are you now? We can't get through on your phone. Mum's a bit worried. Can you message us? Alex? Alex! FFS, Alex! Call! The capitalized scream marked the tipping point when the gentle reminders became a full-throated roar of panic. It's been 4 days since anyone saw my sister and her friend. Please keep sharing and posting. It's been 5 days. 6 days. And the community had kicked in. Let your families know you're okay, Alex and Rosie, please. Was that you I bought a drink for last night in Oxy's place? Ring your parents. They just want to know you are safe. Don't be so selfish. Contact your family. The parents will give them such a rocket when they pitch up, Sparks thought, causing all this fuss. Bet they wish they'd never agreed to let them go. He'd never had to struggle with that decision. His children hadn't been the adventurous sort. He couldn't even remember discussing gap years with them. Jim had been set on going to university and getting on with his career in accountancy, and his daughter Sam had already fallen in love, so she wasn't going anywhere. Wonder if their lives would have turned out differently if they'd gone to Thailand, he mused, idly scrolling back through the messages. Kate Waters' son had gone. She'd confided in him when they'd last met to discuss a case. He didn't normally get into personal stuff with reporters, but Kate had clearly needed to talk, telling him about the silences from Jake that stretched into months, and how she secretly worried he was struggling but didn't want to admit it to her husband. Sparks hadn't liked to say his secret worry about his son was that he was getting old before his time. Jim was only in his 30s, but his hair was thinning, and he wore slippers in the house. They've got oak flooring, Eileen had said when he'd mentioned it. He's fine. But he was never going to go to a full moon party. Perhaps he and Eileen had got off lightly. He flicked back to look at the laughing faces of the missing girls. Fresh faces. Lost children. Where were they? He'd ring Kate later and tell her about the story. Get things moving.
Chapter 4. Friday, the 15th of August, 2014. The Reporter. Joe Jackson is sitting in my chair to watch the newsroom television, and I swat him as I pass, catching his shoulder. Oi, Jackson, out! He grins up at me and pushes back from the desk, freewheeling out of my way, and I see Jake in my head, messing around, hair in his eyes, teasing me.
Get on with your work, I growl.
I'm making calls. He shows me his mobile as proof, jumps up and pulls my chair back into position.
Nothing much to tell yet. I've got a bit of time before the forward planning meeting. I hope Terry doesn't call it early.
As if by magic, the news editor appears from the goldfish bowl, his glass-walled cubicle of an office.
He's bugged our desks, hasn't he?
Joe murmurs, and I nod.
What are you whispering about?
Terry shouts across.
It had better be a story. Your hit rate is a joke, Jackson.
As the youngest staff reporter in the newsroom, Joe Jackson is an easy target for so-called banter. Bullying, if we're being honest. Joe and I had a prickly start when he was first assigned to me for work experience. I told Terry I didn't have time to run the office creche, but the editor insisted. But he's grown on me. I know the other reporters call him my office son or the chief reporter's bitch, but I ignore it. I hope he does too. I keep telling him they'll get bored sooner or later and find another game. Here, put this up to Terry, I say, slipping a cutting across the desk. It's got follow-up written all over it.
Thanks. I owe you another one.
Put it on the slate. Now make a call on it, so you'll sound like you know what you're talking about. I flick a quick look at Terry. He's heard it all. He hears everything. He pulls a face. Soft touch, it says. I shrug back and pick up my phone to avoid talking to him. I scroll through my contacts, looking for a likely target, and stop at DI Bob Sparks. I see his name most days. I've filed him under his first name to keep him near the top of the list, but today I don't go past. I press it. I need a friendly voice this morning, and he might have a story. Bob Sparks and I have enjoyed, or maybe he'd say endured, the sort of forced intimacy that working on difficult cases brings. It's a fact of life that detectives and reporters find themselves knocking on the same doors in search of the facts and cooped up in the same pubs, courtrooms and cafes. For some officers, reporters are a cross to bear, and they make us sweat for every piece of information. But Sparks is a generous copper. He knows what we need to tell the story and is usually happy to oblige. He doesn't play games.
Suits all of us to work together,
he said once.
The police get the publicity they need for the investigation, and some recognition for the work done, and you get your story.
And he deserves the recognition. He works his socks off to get a result. I've seen him do it. 8 years ago, in the Bella Elliott case, he spent every waking hour looking for the missing toddler, thinking about her. He said he dreamed about her too. And even in cases he wasn't running, he's acted as my touchstone. When I was trying to find the identity of a baby whose remains were found on a London building site in 2012, he was there on the end of the phone. He didn't have to do it. But I'd relied on him for grown-up advice when I got too involved, too close to see what was in front of me. It's not exactly Morse and Lewis, but we rub along. Of course, it means that he knows far too much about me. I know I overshare sometimes, telling him about my problems and private thoughts, but I trust him. The phone rings.
Kate,
the voice says sharply, startling me. Good grief, Bob. Have you been issued with new psychic powers? I was just about to call you.
Must have been thinking about each other at the same moment.
I can feel myself blushing. For Christ's sake, get a grip, woman. Thinking about me? In a good way? Or cursing me?
In a good way, Kate,
he replies evenly. He doesn't do flirting. Never been a swordsman. I try not to smile. He'll hear it in my voice. Go on, then. What were you thinking?
I've got an inquiry that you might be able to help with. Two teenage girl backpackers in Thailand have been reported missing by their families. They haven't been in touch for a week, so it's early days, but they missed phoning up for their exam results yesterday, and their parents are very anxious. My sergeant thinks they'll probably turn up with a hangover, but a story might winkle them out of whichever bar they're sitting in. Anyway, I thought of you. And Jake.
Bob Sparks knows about Jake, how he dropped out of university, and the row it caused. I told him after the building site baby case finished, when we were having a quiet drink to decompress. He's got grown-up kids too. He knows how god-awful being a parent is sometimes, and he listens carefully. He always listens well, Bob. A trained ear. But he hasn't told me about Eileen's illness. I found out about the cancer from another copper. I was shocked. More that Bob hadn't confided in me than about the cancer, if I'm honest. I've tried to prompt him to tell me since then, mentioning Steve and his work in oncology a couple of times, but Sparks has never taken the bait. Sure. How old are the girls? Are there photos? Where are they from? Can I speak to the parents?
Good grief, Kate. Slow down. You're like a greyhound out of the traps. They're 18 and from Winchester. Look, I'll send you the details as soon as we get off the phone.
Great. Are you putting it all round?
I have to ask. Yes, the press office is writing something to put on the tape at the moment.
Any chance you could give me a couple of hours' head start, Bob? There's a pause. I wait him out.
Go on, then, he says. It's hardly breaking news. I'll ask them to hold on to it until after lunch.
Brilliant. Thanks, Bob.
Anyway, how is Jake?
I've forgotten my son. Pushed past him in the rush to write about someone else's child. What sort of mother are you? Not sure. He rang in the middle of the night a couple of weeks ago. First call for months. But it sounded like it was from some jungle outpost and I lost the line.
What a shame. Still, he did call.
Yes, he did. I have to be grateful for that, I suppose.
The parents of Alex O'Connor and Rosie Shaw would be, Kate.
I can hear the edge of censure in his voice and try not to react. I scribble down the names. Yes, well, okay. Send the missing girl stuff as soon as you can. I'm sure I can get it in the paper. There's nothing else happening. And Bob, thanks for holding it. I appreciate it. I open my laptop to wait for his email. My inbox has filled again. It's only been half an hour since I weeded out the overnight mass mailings, but there were a dozen new PR puffs about television shows and celebrities selling ghosted memoirs with promises of amazing revelations. I don't know why I'm getting so much showbiz dross, I regularly grumble to Joe. But actually I do. My name has joined a list of journos who write the celeb stories. I'm a marked woman. I used to be a serious reporter, whatever that means these days. I spent yesterday afternoon writing a heartwarming, in my head I'm raking the air with ironic quotation marks, story about a dog adopting ducklings. It probably ate them after the photographer left, I told Steve when I got home. God, I hate August. Bloody silly season. We're in a news-free zone, scratching around for stories when the whole country has gone on holiday. The editor gave me back one of my old spreads this afternoon. He must have stashed it in his bottom drawer in the new year, told me to dust it off so he could put it in the paper. I had to make sure no one in it had died in the meantime. Steve had poured me another glass of Sauvignon Blanc and clinked glasses in sympathy. I deleted the offending emails without opening them, my eye automatically on alert for anything from Jake. His emails are never in answer to my or Steve's regular messages. When they arrive, they're short and to the point, two or three sentences, more like a telegram than a letter, telling us he's still alive and, clearly, not thinking about us. We still pore over them, looking for meaning in every word. It's been 2 years since he embarked on his journey to find himself in Southeast Asia. He should have been studying for his bar exams this year. He'd been doing so well at university before. We'd dreamed of him becoming a barrister. We were excited for him. I suppose, looking back, perhaps we were more excited than he was. But he always was relaxed and cool. Used to drive me mad. He was a lucky boy, bright and lucky. But he wasn't grateful. He had it too easy, maybe. He'd never had to struggle to get top grades, not like his little brother. It was Freddie we worried about. Steve and I tried to hide it from him. We kept our agonized discussions about his future for after he'd gone to bed. Poor Freddie. Always in Jake's shadow at school. Then, out of the blue, Jake had come home and casually announced he'd jacked in his degree and was going travelling. He'd said he was thinking about joining a turtle conservation project in Phuket, and there'd been an almighty row. I'd raged at him that he was ruining his life, and we were barely speaking when he left for Thailand. We didn't hear from him for the first month, and Steve blamed me. "He thinks you're still angry," he'd said. "I am still angry," I'd snapped back.
"You need to be careful, Kate, or you'll lose him."
I'd wanted to shout, "How do you lose a son? He's been part of me for 22 years. I will always be his mother." But I kept it to myself. I hid the hurt and pretended to be indifferent to his silence. But fear had taken root inside me, creating lurid images of him dying in a motorbike crash or being brutally mugged. Being a reporter means I know that these things happen to people like us. Chapter 5. Friday the 15th of August 2014. The Reporter. It's been 5 minutes and still no email. I sit fidgeting with my phone, trying to decide whether to ring Bob Sparks back and ask when he's going to push the send button. He said he'd do it immediately, but he'll hate it if I chase him. I put the phone down. I'll have a look myself. Everything's on the net. And when I type in the names, the missing girls are there. Bingo. But a blog. Oh, I hate blogs. Blah, 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 dressed up as journalism, I told Joe once, my guard down.
God, you sound like my mum, he'd said.
His mother, a recently retired editor, had been widely mocked by the wicked press as a Fleet Street dinosaur. That had shut me up. I wasn't about to be kicked into the long grass with her. The blogger is another backpacker, sounding the alarm and urging Alex and Rosie to get in touch with their families. I wonder how many of the thousands of teenagers who set off for a gap year go missing. Must be fewer now everyone has a smartphone and Wi-Fi, but still. I stare at the screen. My heartbeat feels like it's bruising my ribs. My child is missing too. At home, we all pretend that everything's fine. He's an adult, living his own life, making his own choices. But we don't even know which country he's in, really. I've Googled the price of plane tickets to Thailand so many times. Just looking, I tell myself. And I've secretly emailed dozens of conservation projects in Phuket over the last 2 years, asking for him. But Jake hasn't registered with any of them. He could be anywhere. But I've kept it to myself. No point worrying Steve. Sometimes I wonder if he's done the same and is keeping it secret from me. I write Jake an email straight away. Hi, just wondering where you are and what you are doing. Thanks for ringing the other night. It was lovely to hear your voice. We miss you. Freddie finally passed his driving test. Let me know when you pick this up. M. Kiss. I don't know when he'll get it, but it's out there for when he next logs in.
Kate, Joe's saying. Kate, I asked where you found this cutting. Please, Terry's about to call the meeting.
What? Can't you look online? Think it was one of the Sunday magazines. Is it on shiny paper? Oh, say the Sunday Express. No one ever reads it.
Are you coming in?
What time is it in Bangkok, Joe?
Afternoon or evening, I think. They're ahead of us, aren't they? Why?
But I'm already dialing the Post's former Southeast Asia correspondent and waving Joe away. I'll be in a minute. Just need to check something. Don Richards answers on the first ring.
Yes,
he barks, daring the caller to carry on disturbing him. Don, it's Kate Waters, on the Post. The voice softens to gruff.
Ah, the lovely Kate. How are you? Christ, when did I last see you? Must be 10 years ago, when you came to cover the tsunami. That was a hell of a story, wasn't it? Paid for my new bungalow.
I grit my teeth. Don's sensitivity button was disabled a long time ago.
Living out here does it to you,
he'd confessed back then, when we were both drunk and exhausted after weeks of horrifying sights and testimonies.
It blunts you. I've become some terrible old colonial cliché.
I'd bought us another beer and steered him back to his glory days. God, is it 10 years already? I say. We must be getting old, Don. Look, I know you're busy, so I'll keep it short. I wondered if you were working on two missing British girls, Alex O'Connor and Rosie Shaw?
Well, the Backpacker Network is talking about them, but this happens all the time. The embassy here gets one or two reported missing every day. Bloody thoughtless teenagers. The families have been trying to make contact for a week, apparently, but kids drift through. They meet someone in a bar, hear about a new place, and head off. Those girls are probably shacked up with some boys and having too good a time to tell anyone. Anyway, why are you asking? Are you being sent on it?
I smile. Don can smell the money. Can't see them sending me this early, but I'm going to talk to Terry about it. Could be a good story. Every parent's nightmare with kids all heading off on their gap years at the moment, and there's nothing else happening here.
I'll send you some copy. You will put me down for a credit, won't you?
The cry of the lesser-spotted freelance. Giss a credit. Course, Don. Send over what you've got, and I'll put a payment through. Have you been in touch with the families? I'm going to give them a call.
Only via Facebook. The O'Connors are making the most noise.
Terry's head appears round the door of the meeting room.
Get your arse in here, Kate. You're the chief reporter. Set an example, for goodness sake.
Bangkok, day one, Sunday the 27th of July, 2014. Alex O'Connor, Sunday at 8:30 a.m, is staying in the penthouse of Bates Motel. YOLO. She and Rosie had fallen out of the bus at a vast roundabout straddling what looked like the M3 in the city centre. It was the driver who'd told them they'd reached their stop. Democracy Monument, he said. Khao San Road. Standing beside four lanes of traffic, any remnant of elation had died in Alex's stomach. This wasn't what she'd been expecting. She'd seen pictures of the old town and this wasn't it. Where were the narrow streets and alleys? Rosie had looked at her expectantly. Where's our hotel? She'd said. Hostel, Alex had corrected, looking at the itinerary on her phone. It's the Green Paradise and it's only 15 minutes walk from here, according to this. But which way? She hadn't been sure and was too tired to think sensibly. She'd planned to find the way on her phone but had forgotten to buy a Thai SIM card at the airport. She'd headed off, trying to look as if she knew what she was doing, and Rosie had followed. This way, she had said, muttering, I think, as insurance. It wasn't that way, and no one had seemed to understand when she asked and showed them the hostel name. This is a nightmare, Rosie had said, and Alex had quickened her pace to get out of earshot. When they finally stumbled into Khao San Road, shop fronts were opening down alleyways. Pans of water were coming to the boil on wood fires and gas stoves. Child-sized green and red plastic stools were scattered outside, ready for the first sitting of the day. But there was still no sign of their hostel. Rosie's sulk was turning to loud despair when Alex spotted Mama's Paradise Bar and Guesthouse down a side road. This was on my list as well, she lied. Well, it's got paradise in the name. Let's forget the other one and ask here. Right, Rosie said. It looks okay, Alex said, as they peered into the gloom beyond the bar front. She and Rosie were given a room on the top floor. An astonishing figure in a flowing caftan and platinum blonde wig had towered over them with a wide smile. I am Mama, she said. This is my place. I will put you in private room on second floor. It sounded as if it was the royal suite. It wasn't. It was like a doss house. Not that she'd ever been in one, but Alex had read Down and Out in Paris and London for A-level and imagined the room would fit Orwell's brief. They trudged with their backpacks up dark concrete stairs, Alex first, clutching the key like a lucky charm. The room number had been painted on the wall in black paint, and when she opened the door, the vinegary stench of old trainers pushed past them into the corridor. Seriously? Rosie said. It's cheap, Alex snapped, too tired for the row brewing. It's 150 baht a night, £3. We can't expect much more. And we're not staying long. I guess not. It'll be an experience, Alex said. Yes. It's not that bad, Alex added weakly, taking in the full horror. And we won't be spending much time in here. That's lucky, Rosie muttered, looking pointedly at the cream-coloured walls, smeared with squashed mosquitoes. Alex went to close the thin curtains at the window, looking out onto the corridor. They gaped. There weren't enough hooks. It was certainly no frills. Their room contained a fan, a single plastic chair, and a small double bed. The sheet bore the mark of generations of sweating tourists, the central dip darker than the rest of the material. Love the pillows, Rosie said, still not moving from the doorway. Ghostly imprints of cartoon kittens stared out, their giant, once appealing eyes barely visible after hundreds of washes. Come on, Alex muttered. Which side do you want? She hadn't counted on sharing a bed and knew from the plane that Rosie snored. The side furthest from the mozzie graveyard, Rosie said, her voice sullen. I hope you don't snore. She plonked her bag down and sat heavily on the bed. Alex did the same. At that moment, she wanted more than anything to go home. I'm going to have a shower. She fought the tremor in her voice and began rummaging for a toothbrush and soap. Rosie widened her eyes. God knows what that would be like. Cockroach City. I've never seen a cockroach. Alex said. Another first? They suddenly realised two Thai women were in the corridor outside, peeping through the gap in the curtains, watching their every move. The shower? Alex opened the door and mimed rain over her head. They pointed wordlessly down the corridor. The girls edged past them and inspected a tiny room with a tiled floor, drain hole and sputtering showerhead. Limp, faded towels hung on a hook. Okay, I'm going in, Alex said in a comedy American accent. If I'm not back in 5 minutes, call Dino Rudd. And Rosie laughed. Thank God for that, Alex thought. Later, when they were sitting at the bar with their hair still wet, Mama emerged from the gloom at the back. Rosie nudged Alex. She could play for the England rugby team. Mama gave them a look, and Alex worried that she'd heard, but she proceeded to sweep up the rubbish in front of her property. Dirty people, she hissed at a passerby who spat out his chewing gum. Her lipstick had left a red slick on her teeth. It was probably still early for the traveller crowd, only just midday, and hangovers of every shade of grey showed on the faces of those who'd made it out of bed. A boy their age walked past wearing just a pair of shorts, thin, greenish skin and old eyes, dragging on a cigarette as if it were his last breath. Alex was about to say how ill he looked, but Rosie chirped up. Looks like people are having a good time.
Chapter 6. Friday the 15th of August, 2014. The Reporter. It hasn't taken much persuading for Terry to buy into the story. The news list is cigarette paper thin.
I see you've decided to create a wish list this morning, Mr. News Editor. I can't see a natural story on this.
The editor, Simon Pearson, had shouted from his office door, waving the offending document in his hand. Terry had grinned, as if it were a joke, but we all knew he'd get a kicking when the door closed. He puts a brave face on it when he emerges, but his news list is screwed up in a ball in one fist.
We're splashing on the missing girls,
he says, as if it were his idea. It's a bit soft for the front, Terry, I say. It is. Girls fail to email parents while on holiday is hardly a headline.
Then give it a kick up the arse, Kate. It's the only story I've got today.
I watch as he barricades himself in his cubicle and sits staring into space. I wonder how long he'll go on, taking the flak 12 hours a day. He always says he loves it, loves the buzz, being at the centre of things. But he looks more like a victim of domestic violence every day. I'd better make the story work. Malcolm O'Connor answers on the first ring. He must be sitting beside the phone. Hello, Mr. O'Connor. I'm so sorry to disturb you, but I'm ringing about your daughter, Alex. I'm a reporter for the Daily Post, and I want to help you find her. I try to picture the man on the other end of the line. Middle-aged, thinning hair. Desperate, anyway. I'd hoped to get the mother. Women are so much easier to talk to about grief, emotions, loss. Blokes, even fathers, struggle to find the words. And putting on a brave face sounds so cold in print. There is silence on the line. Mr. O'Connor?
Sorry, yes, I think you'd better talk to my wife.
There's the sound of voices in another room and the rustle of movement before the phone is picked up. Hello? Who is this? Kate Waters, Mrs. O'Connor. I was just telling your husband that I work for the Daily Post, and I want to help you find Alex. The Post? It's not the one we read, but... Have you heard anything? What have you been told? You must know more than us. I probably only know as much as you, Mrs. O'Connor. Less, if I'm honest. I'm talking to Hampshire Police and our correspondent in Bangkok, but there isn't much information yet. Why don't you tell me what you've heard? Just that they've notified Interpol, and we've spoken to the embassy in Bangkok. They say we have to wait. I don't know how much longer we can do that. Her voice is slipping, and I know she's about to break down. Using Facebook is a great idea, I say, steering her away from tears. I need her to talk, not cry. You must be reaching thousands of backpackers and tourists over there.
So my son Dan tells me,
she says wearily.
I only joined Facebook when Alex went off. She said there'd be photos for me to look at. We'd be able to see what she was up to, but there's been nothing for a week now. Nobody's heard from her. Nobody knows anything. We waited. We thought she'd probably gone on a trip for a couple of days. But we'd arranged for her to ring yesterday for her results, her A-levels. She was desperate to know if she'd got into university. And if she didn't have the right grades, she knew she'd have to ring round to find another place.
Yes, I remember that, I say. Jake had sailed into his first choice, but there'd been a day of agonising telephone calls for Freddie, me standing beside him in the school hall, encouraging him with smiles and nods to bear the humiliation of rejection. In the end, he took the offer of a media studies course in Birmingham. It wouldn't have been my choice, 3 years pretending to be a journalist and building up a huge debt. But I was too exhausted by the process to fight about it. He's enjoying it, he says. What about Rosie? I ask.
No, nothing from her either. But it was usually Alex who did the messages. Rosie was a bit less, you know.
Yes, I've got one like that.
Look, could I come and see you, Leslie? Is it okay if I call you Leslie? To talk to you properly? It's hard on the phone, isn't it? I could drive down now, if you like.
There's a pause, and I can hear Leslie O'Connor whispering to her husband.
She wants to come and see us.
I can't hear the reply. But seconds later, Leslie says,
Okay. Have you got our address?
Mick Murray drives. He prefers it that way.
I've got all my camera gear in the boot. It's simpler if we take my car. And you're a shit driver.
I get into the passenger seat, edging empty Coke bottles and evidence of ancient takeaways to the side of the footwell with my shoe, and try to ignore the overflowing ashtray. But he sees me looking.
Sorry, haven't had it valeted this week.
This week? This century, more like. There are Big Mac boxes older than my kids in here.
Bit of a skip on wheels. But it's home.
He laughs, lighting a ciggy. Anyway, Terry is determined to splash the story. It's a bit thin, if you ask me, but it is August.
Picture desk is desperate too. We'll make it work. They're pretty girls. There are a couple of photos of them in front of a temple on the Brothers Appeal page.
Hopefully the mum and dad will let us have more. Poor things. They sound nice people. Mick nods, throws his cigarette butt out of the window, and fishes yet another out of the packet on the dashboard. He lights it and inhales deeply. Bloody hell, Mick, open a window. I'm smoking that cigarette for you. He laughs, making himself cough as if he's dying.
You reform smokers are the worst. Enjoy it. It's a free one.
I open my window and think about the interview. We pull up outside the address, one of a terrace of red brick houses on the outskirts of the affluent market town. I'm taking it all in, but as I get out of the car, my phone rings. It's Steve, but the rumble of traffic makes it hard to hear him.
Sorry, love. I'm standing on a pavement about to do an interview. Can we talk later?
Just wanted to remind you about tonight. We're meeting Henry and Deepika for tapas, remember?
He shouts.
Yes, yes.
I'd forgotten. Steve would say it was deliberate, but I've got a lot on my mind, and I can't stand Henry. He may be one of Steve's fellow consultants, but he's also an arse. He's a man who thinks it's funny to put his wife down in company and then crow,
I'm joking,
when people look uncomfortable. Deepika, a partner in a law firm, appears not to mind. She laughs along when he calls her she who must be obeyed, and says his marriage is like a life sentence. But it sticks in my craw. The last time he did it, I ordered another glass of wine, despite Steve giving me the you've had enough look.
Tell him if he channels Bernard Manning tonight, I'll ram a scorched padron pepper up his nose, I shout back.
Katie, you will behave, won't you?
Steve laughs, but I can hear the tension in his voice.
Might, love you. Bye.
Who are you going to assault with a chili?
Mick says, shouldering his bag of cameras. None of your business. Come on. Let's get on with it. Chapter 7. Friday, the 15th of August, 2014. The Reporter. The O'Connor's front room is an assault course of furniture and knick-knacks, and I have to negotiate an upholstered footstool, a large trembling orchid, and a sharp-cornered coffee table to reach the armchair Leslie indicates. Another woman is sitting on the sofa with a mug of tea already in her hand.
This is Rosie's mum, Jenny. We rang her to let her know you were coming and she wanted to be here,
Leslie says quickly. But you don't seem keen on the idea, I think. Wonder why? Jenny nods at me wordlessly and takes another sip of tea.
Hello, Mrs. Shaw. I'm Kate and this is Mick, my...
Mick cuts me off with a look.
I'm the photographer, working with Kate on the story, he says.
He's become increasingly narky if I forget myself and call him my photographer.
I'm not your fucking monkey,
he hisses. Leslie O'Connor pretends not to notice.
Tea,
she says in the sudden silence. I nod gratefully.
Two more teas, Malcolm,
she calls through the door. Leslie's about the same age as me. Early 50s, I'd guess. She's wearing supermarket mum jeans, sandals the colour of elastoplast, and a long T-shirt. No makeup, no earrings. I unbutton my suit jacket and quickly slip it off. I don't want to look like an official. Leslie, I start, but she breaks in with,
Did you find us all right?
She's putting off the evil moment of having to talk about it. Fine. No problems. Thank you so much for seeing us. I lean forward in my chair to make eye contact. Why didn't you tell me about Alex, Leslie? She must have been so excited about going on this trip. Leslie gives me a grateful smile. Remembering the happy times before this last week is where she wants to be.
She was. They both were. Weren't they, Jenny?
Jenny Shaw doesn't look up from her mug of tea, and I feel the tension in the room ratchet up a notch. But Leslie carries on, apparently oblivious.
She couldn't talk about anything else. She was going to go with her best friend, Max, to begin with, but that all fell through, and Rosie stepped in. Alex spent hours on the internet, looking at the islands, how to get there, you know, bus routes, ferries, and where to stay. She had it all planned. They were going for 3 months, and then they'd see, they said. They thought they might go on to Australia, if they could find some work. It was quite a trip then. Had they been travelling before?
No,
Jenny Shaw says, her first word.
No, that's right, Leslie adds quickly. First time away from home like this for both of them. But they are sensible girls, and they had everything planned. Alex did a spreadsheet.
I hear what sounds like a snort from Jenny Shaw. Sorry, Jenny. I missed that, I say.
I didn't say anything. Jenny's very upset, Leslie offers. We all are.
Malcolm O'Connor puts down the tray he's dressed with milk jug, sugar bowl, chocolate digestives, and a teapot with cosy. Standards not being allowed to slip, I note.
We are, yes,
he says, sitting down on the sofa between his wife and Jenny.
We need to find them,
Leslie says, and takes her husband's hand.
We're desperate. Not sleeping, imagining the worst.
Why did you sound the alarm, Leslie? Had Alex said something to worry you?
No, nothing like that. That's just it, they were having a great time. But we've heard nothing for days, and it's not like them. There was an arrangement for the girls to contact us every other day. A Facebook message, a text, or an email if they had time. And their A-level results came out yesterday. I haven't opened the envelope yet because we wanted to do it with Alex.
She knew it was August the 14th. She emailed to say what time she'd ring. She knew we'd be waiting to hear from her, didn't she, Mal? He nods and lets go of her hand to pour the tea. Would it be possible to see the emails, Leslie? I'd like to use some of the girls' own words if I can.
Why?
Jenny says. To make the story sing is not what they will want to hear. To give them a voice in the story, I say instead. It is about them, after all. She looks dubious, so I move on. Who have you spoken to in Thailand, Leslie?
We've been in touch with the embassy out there. They've been very nice, but they say it's early days, that this happens a lot. They had more than 400 tourists reported missing last year. They said that people turn up again quickly, that we shouldn't panic, and we're trying not to.
Leslie gulps the last word of the sentence and stops. I keep eye contact, nodding encouragement, and she takes a breath and goes on.
She should have been in touch. Alex is a lovely girl. She wouldn't want us to suffer like this. We know she'd booked a hostel in Bangkok, the Green Paradise, but when we rang, they said she never turned up. We don't know which one she went to. She called it Bates Motel on Facebook like it was a joke. I didn't know they'd changed hostels. She didn't mention it when she phoned first time. There was so much else to talk about. She was buzzing with it all, so excited. They were loving Bangkok, and she told us all about the temples and the new friends she was making. Then nothing. No one has heard from her, none of her friends. We've rung them all. Her phone is switched off. We just don't know.
Malcolm puts his arm round her. Jenny Shaw looks completely isolated, perched at the far end of the sofa, and I reach over and touch her arm to bring her into the interview. What about you, Jenny? How are you and your husband coping? Ex-husband? Shit. Right, sorry. It must be a very difficult time for you. Jenny Shaw takes a deep breath. She looks so brittle she might break at any moment. Yes, she says. Very difficult. She's my only one. She shouldn't even be in Thailand. She should be starting her course, a degree in midwifery. But she decided to defer for a year.
To go travelling? I prompt.
Yes. Well, it was Alex's idea, but she persuaded Rosie to go. Leslie shoots her what looks like a warning glance.
They're best friends, then? I plough on.
Not really. They've only known each other a couple of years, since we moved in down the road. We had to downsize after the divorce.
I nod sympathetically.
That must have been tough.
We managed, Jenny says tartly. I was very surprised when Rosie said she wanted to go to Thailand with Alex. The girls went to the same sixth form college, but they didn't spend that much time together. And they'll be going to different universities when they come back.
There is a beat of silence in the room. When? Did Rosie do well in her exams? I say.
I haven't opened the results either, but I'm sure she'll have done fine.
What sort of girl is Rosie?
She's a bright girl.
Jenny's voice is getting tighter, and she sounds breathless.
But she's young, and sometimes can get caught up in things. Not bad things. But just lately, she gets an idea in her head and you can't shift it.
Like going travelling?
Yes, like going travelling. I thought she should start her degree, like she planned. But she wouldn't listen. And then her father loaned her the money so she could go.
She speaks carefully, checking each statement with a small, self-referential nod. She reminds me of a bird in a cage, that bobbing movement of the head.
Is your husband, sorry, ex-husband, involved in the campaign to find her?
No. His new wife needs him at home. She's had a baby. The subtext of blame and a family triangulated by divorce goes unspoken, for the moment. But I can feel it simmering, and I wonder how long it will be before it boils over. Won't be long if Rosie isn't found. Jenny will need someone to point the finger at.
The police say the girls might have gone on a trip for a few days where there's no Wi-Fi or phone signal,
Malcolm O'Connor says and shakes his head. Leslie looks at her husband.
Why does everyone keep saying that? We think they were still in Bangkok when they last messaged. Alex said she'd booked to go and see some elephants. They were having a wonderful time.
She stops. The past tense has slipped past her guard.
I'm so frightened we've lost her. I keep thinking about her at the airport, waving to us from the security queue. Off on her big adventure.
Tears slide down her face, dripping off her chin, onto her husband's bare arm.
Sorry,
she mutters, wiping them away with her sleeve, and she makes to get up. Give yourself a moment, Leslie, I say quietly, fishing a tissue out of my bag. Of course you're frightened. What parent wouldn't be? Have you got a picture of them at the airport? Jenny gets up and squeezes past their knees. She's crying too.
I need a minute, she says.
Oh, Jenny, stay,
Leslie sobs, but her neighbour disappears into the hall. She turns to me.
We feel so out of control. You will help us, won't you?
I go and sit on the sofa, in Jenny's place, and lean over to squeeze her hand. Of course I will. I'll write a story as soon as we've finished talking, to keep people looking. The post is read online all over the world. Leslie looks suddenly wary. She's just remembered I'm a reporter.
What will you say?
That you're desperate to find Alex and Rosie, and are frightened for them. I'll write about the girls, and the last information you have about their movements. We'll need photographs of them and you. We want other parents to understand what you're going through.
Well, if you think it will do some good,
Leslie falters. Jenny has reappeared, standing in the doorway and dabbing at her eyes.
What do you think, Jenny?
Leslie says. Jenny stares at the carpet.
Okay,
she says.
Bangkok, day 2. Monday the 28th of July, 2014. Alex O'Connor, Monday at 6:30 a.m. is really here. Never stop believing. She'd been about to cancel the whole trip a month ago when her best friend Mags dropped out. It'd been the day they'd been due to buy the plane tickets, and Mags had turned up at the house to tell her she'd changed her mind. She just didn't have enough money. She was so sorry. Alex had been too stunned to have a row. Afterwards, she wondered if her friend had ever really intended to come. And then Rosie had begged to come with her. Alex had been amazed. For a start, they weren't really friends' friends. They hadn't grown up together like her and Mags. Rosie had only moved into Alex's street at the start of sixth form, and they were doing different subjects. It had been Alex's mum who'd suggested she walk with Rosie to college at the beginning of their first term and introduce her to her friends, that kind of thing. She's new, Alex. Be nice. The first time they'd met had been when Rosie and her mum, no dad, had come round for an excruciating welcome lunch. Alex had opened the door to their guests. The girl on the doorstep was smaller than her, had a perky blonde ponytail, and was wearing a short flowery play suit and high wedges to match. Alex had tugged her Hogwarts t-shirt out of her jeans self-consciously and waved her in. Didn't realise we were dressing up, she'd muttered to her mother as they processed into the living room. They'd had an awkward, what subjects are you taking for A-level, moment before her mum called them in to eat. Rosie had brightened when Dan, Alex's big brother, appeared, and she'd taken the chair beside him at the table, monopolising him with her dimples and big-eyed questions. Alex had slumped into moody silence. She'd endured the meal until after the apple charlotte, Leslie's signature dish, her dad had announced, and Alex had wanted to die. If that wasn't bad enough, the parental one-upmanship had swiftly followed. Rosie is going to study midwifery at university, her mother Jenny had said. It's what she's always wanted to do. She'll need good grades to do it, but she's very bright. Alex's mum had put on her tight smile and said, That sounds lovely. Alex wants to do an academic subject, don't you, love? The girls had risen as one and headed for the patio. Sorry about that. She goes on a bit about the nursing thing, Rosie had said. I'm not sure I'll get the grades, but she's desperate for me to do it. Mine's as bad, Alex had smiled. Tiger mothers, eh? It had felt like a bonding moment, but somehow they hadn't been able to build on it. Alex had never been sure why. Normally, she was the go-to person for problems and advice in her group. The head girl, her friends joked. But on their walks to college, when Alex had tried chatting about books she'd read, Rosie only read set books and Heat magazine, and films she wanted to see, brainless rom-coms were her new friend's pick, it turned out Rosie was all about boys. That's all. She wanted boys to look at her, tell her she was pretty, admire her outfit. She couldn't care less about anything else. Alex had tried some Me Toos, telling Rosie about a boy she was seeing, and there was a spark of interest. It became their default subject. And when Alex broke up with him, she'd cried a bit, and Rosie had given her a tissue and said she'd get over him. But the truth was that she and Rosie had never got beyond the social media chatter stage. We're like Facebook friends, she told her mother, who looked blank. We talk, but don't really connect. Right, her mum had said. Well, you tried. At the start of the winter term, when Rosie had begun taking the bus to college, it's cold and I get an extra 20 minutes in bed, Alex had shrugged and left her to it. They still stopped to say hello when they ran into each other, and they had gone to each other's birthday parties, but Alex had long been relieved of big sister duties. So when she'd found Rosie waiting for her outside college, the day after Mags's bombshell, she hadn't come close to guessing what was coming. I hear you've been let down, Rosie had blurted without preamble. Everyone was talking about it at lunch. I'm really sorry. Thanks, Rosie, Alex had said, genuinely touched. I'm not sure what I'm going to do, really. My mum doesn't want me to go on my own. Well, can I come instead? Please? Thailand sounds fantastic, Rosie had said, slipping her arm through Alex's. You? You want to come? Yes, it'd be brilliant. It's really lovely of you to offer, Alex had said carefully, too stunned to trust herself to reply. But I thought you were going straight to uni.